The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. You're listening to Damian Richardson on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to the show. On this, the last day of the week before we head into the weekend, I hope everyone has a great, wonderful weekend before we get there. It is Friday, the 19th of May, of course. Got a bit of breaking news, always like a bit of breaking news. Just, you know, get on top of it as quickly as I can. Now, just talking in Victoria, there's been a meeting of Victorian Labor parliamentarians, and they've decided that Victorians will not use gas at all by 2030. That's an extraordinary thing to think that my stovetop will be no good in less than 7 years' time. I don't know. They're going to fund us all to install stovetops at the government's expense. Oh, my heating service too, which is also gas. Are they going to, give us some funding, give us a bit of a chop out there at the taxpayers' expense to reheat our houses and to cook our food? And it sounds absurd, but it wouldn't surprise me at all, because otherwise they won't be re-elected, so they'll use the funds that they collect from us to redistribute the funds, and we know how it works, especially people that are listening to this station. You see that Deutsche Bank have settled out of court with claimants in the Epstein case for $75 million because they were continuing to bank with him for 5 years, having known that he was apparently, allegedly, was using the funds to continue his sex trafficking operation. So that's the breaking news for the moment. I'm waiting, just pensively waiting by my screen, waiting for something else to come through to throw me that I have to throw to. But I met a friend yesterday, and I went for a coffee. It was good to catch up, get out of the studio and have a chat with someone else. And we talked about the role of conservative commentators and the role they play in the system as it is at the moment, the mainstream system. So you have this sort of a person that might write for The Australian or The Herald Sun or appear on Sky News. And ultimately, they also want to be on the ABC as well, so that audience can, you know, a studio audience can throw brickbats at them. And then they've made a career out of basically saying nothing. And then they come onto my show and I might ask them something, you know, what do you think about, the ethno state of Israel, you know, the Jewish state? And they go, whoa, hang on, wait a minute. I'm not going there. I am not ruining my career for your silly questions. What is this show anyway? What do you think you're doing on this show? And so what is the role of the conservative commentator if just to say things that you're allowed to say as far as conservative commentators are concerned? And we had a good laugh, which was good to be able to talk to someone that could hear these things, hear these thoughts, and actually, you know, reflect them back to me. And so it was, you'd think it was with great trepidation, of course, that I made the journey out from the Melbourne's northern suburbs to Mornington Peninsula last night, going through the city in peak hour. It took me 2 hours to make this journey to the Mornington Peninsula for a federal executive council meeting of the Liberal Party. And I thought, what am I doing here? I went with trepidation, and of course they're having this meeting to talk about the things that confront the Australian community. And of course there was a guest speaker there talking about The Voice, and there were old Liberal luminaries, Erica Betts and Kevin Andrews were two of them, and they were speaking as well about the role of The Voice. But it never really lifted off the ground. Everyone stayed very civilized and quiet. No one mentioned the weaponization of 750,000 new arrivals to this country, and they'll be weaponized through The Voice too, because what happens often, I think, is what the left side of politics, or the deep state is probably a better way of putting it, utilize The Voice for, is like to identify a minority interest group and to say, well, this interest group has been horrifically oppressed by the regime that we now all profit from anyway, but we'll put that aside. We'll just identify them as being a victim group, and they'll say, well, look, if these people here, these, colonialists are going to treat the original people like this, imagine what they might do to you people. You're obviously coming here because you feel like it's a good place to come, but nonetheless, watch out for these colonialists. They could turn on you at any point. So if you don't vote for this minority interest group, then perhaps you won't vote in your own interest either. Now, that would be absurd, wouldn't it? So they often, that's how they win these votes ultimately. And you could imagine if I came here to this country and I came from Iraq, say, and I went through the Western education system, and its system told me how bad we had been to its original first inhabitants. Well, if these people are saying this about themselves, if they're owning up about themselves, and this is the power structure, that they've been treated these people so abominably, well, what respect am I even going to have for this nation? So what does it even mean anymore to be an Australian? Now, I would have asked these people at the Mornington FEC what it actually means to be an Australian, what it means to be have an alternative power source, which would be the institutionalisation of the voice. It would be an alternative power source, especially if it is in the Constitution. What problems might result as that being the occurrence, if there is a yes vote. So we had a woman who was from a land council telling us why the voice was a bad idea, even though she is clearly profiting from being an Aboriginal academic. She identifies as an Aboriginal academic. If she wouldn't have been an Anglo-Saxon academic, because it wouldn't have made any sense. So race actually is at the heart of everything everybody does, yet it dare not mention its name. It definitely dare not mention its name when you're talking to a professional conservative commentator. But we don't do that here, of course, on TNT Radio. So you make sure you keep listening to this this radio station as we continue to try to bring you the truth. You're listening to TNT Radio.
Unbiased and reliable news coverage.
It's the news I trust.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. I welcome back to the show. Last time I spoke to him, Ross Cameron, we started to nut into what is oppressing us in the West. Actually, what aspects is it potentially of the Enlightenment that means we believe in the rational brain, the rational human brain to bring about a utopia? And have dismissed, you know, as superstition, any religious understandings we have may have had of the world previously. Well, we just got to that point, and unfortunately, time beat us. So perhaps we will get there this time. Ross Cameron, welcome to the show.
Good to be back.
Good to have you. That deep, sonorous tones there. Now, before we get to that, obviously, Joe Biden's not coming to Australia anymore, as he was later this month. I think we've got a clip here, and we might even discuss exactly what's going to happen and why Biden is not coming. This is President Biden. He's not going to visit. He's going to the G summit in Japan, but he's cancelled the rest of his trip, and here's what he had to say.
I'm cutting my trip short. I'm postponing the Australia portion of the trip and my stop in Papua New Guinea in order to be back for the final negotiations with congressional leaders. And I spoke today with Prime Minister Albanese of Australia and a short time ago and let him know what was going on. There was an overwhelming consensus, I think, in today's meeting, the congressional leaders, that defaulting on the debt is simply not an option.
Well, who's Papua New Guinea anyway, Ross? Papua, is it? Some old guy in the South Pacific?
Yes. Well, indeed, you know, the Pacific has been seriously neglected by the, you know, by its traditional allies, if you like, for a very long period of time. And even Australian governments have sort of waxed and waned between having a minister responsible for the Pacific. Because we find that federal ministers prefer to be making trips to Paris and Washington rather than to Kiribati and the Solomon Islands and Port Moresby. We prefer the more glamorous destinations, which is interestingly why the likewise the so-called COP or Copenhagen or Carbon crowd prefer their lanyards being issued in beautiful and exotic five-star hotels by the pool rather than by the countries which are allegedly being swallowed by rising sea levels. So, you know, what we find now, however, is that as China becomes increasingly you know, effective, if you like, in its diplomatic outreach, suddenly we've all rediscovered the Pacific. And, you know, the truth is it's Papua New Guinea was actually going really well under Australian leadership up until the 1970s when it was decided, I think, another decision of Gough Whitlam, which has been a little bit like the sort of South African or Zimbabwe / Rhodesia situation, where under its own leadership, we have to admit that Papua New Guinea has fallen into a trough, into a hole. Mm-hmm. And the most obvious example of which is somewhere like Bougainville has arguably, you know, certainly one of the world's most valuable resources in the ground. Mm-hmm. But the civic relationships have degenerated so badly that even though the country is destitute and entirely reliant on foreign, I think it's 50% of its budget comes from foreign lending mm-hmm. agencies. But it can't dig up any of the gold or the copper because the country is just so violent and the rule of law observed so occasionally. So now we like to, you know, Penny Wong is in effect rushing around with buckets full of cash and our negotiating strategy is entirely reactive while the Chinese are building a highway through the highlands of Papua New Guinea. We kind of turn up to the latest big man on campus with a bucket of cash and say, oh, well, can we prize you away from the nipple of Chinese influence? It's all pretty tawdry.
It depends whose the nipples is to, I'd imagine, as far as Australian diplomacy is concerned. You wouldn't want to delineate whether the nipple belonged to a man or a woman, I'm sure, if you wanted our cash.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, you'd probably, if you asked the Australian diplomat providing it, they, I'm sure, would be totally confused about what a man or a woman is. And, of course, this is one of the reasons why Australian diplomacy has been such a failure in the Pacific, is that instead of going up there doing a more natural survey of what these small countries actually need, which is almost invariably, you know, better roads for population spread out across, you know, island terrains or indeed bridges to link separated communities. We have had a tendency to wish to impose this very abstract WEF-led, intensely ideological agenda, which is almost exclusively limited to climate change and sexuality and sort of promoting abortion. And we say to these countries, you know, you're not really a modern nation unless you jump through all these hoops, but if you do, we'll give you more money. Whereas the Chinese will come in and say, look, we'd like to build you a road through the highlands of Papua New Guinea where you currently have, you know, open utes sliding off dirt roads into the valleys with, you know, a load of kids without seatbelts in the back because you've got no way to surface the road. And we'd like to help you solve that problem. And naturally, it builds more equity in the relationship than we are able to do.
But that's not altruistic, is it? That's to get access to the cultural assets and wealth of that nation, isn't it? Which is something I think Australia would struggle to do now too because there'd be such resistance to it on the home front, or is that not the case?
Well, in my opinion, Australia's foreign policy is hopelessly confused in terms of what its objectives are. I think the truth is, you know, there's probably no nation that engages in a purely altruistic foreign policy, just as no government is purely altruistic in relation to its own citizens. But I think what, you know, China's situation is, because they have this hugely productive economy, they wind up with a powerful export sector, and that generates vast foreign reserves. And the question the government, the Chinese face is, well, what do we do with those reserves? And so the Chinese have said, okay, we are going to design our foreign policy around our natural capability. And that capability has been acquired over four decades of moving a billion people essentially from villages into cities. And in that process, they have acquired a vast depth of capability and confidence in engineering in particular. So they took that capability and knitted it into the Belt and Road matrix as the sort of defining idea of their foreign policy. And so they said, okay, well, we're world's best at building fast rail, power stations, water treatment plants, ports, and airports. So we will take our foreign reserves as a potential source of debt, and we'll take our engineering capability through the, you know, China number three railway company or the China water company or, you know, Sino Petroleum to build fuel refineries. And we will be able to offer a package where we can go into anywhere up and down the, you know, African continent or Southeast Asia or whatever and say we can offer you both the latest generation low emissions coal-fired power station, plus we will provide you with the debt financing facility to pay for it, and it's a very compelling offer.
This presents a real existential crisis for Australia, though, because there's no domestic opposition to the Chinese Communist Party. It presents an autocratic rule. That's something we don't do, well, we think we don't do in the West, or we faced with such an existential crisis now that that's actually the form of government to which we are now looking towards, and you've even espousing it now as more ideal than our foreign diplomacy.
Yeah, I don't necessarily say, it's not necessarily, my reflection is not necessarily related to the form of government as much as it is to the stage of economic development. And so, you know, we have to recognize that China has gone through a transformation economically, which is unprecedented in world history, out of, you know, 190 odd sovereign states recognized by the United Nations, and the last, say, 4,000 years of history. There is no precedent to the speed with which one nation has been transformed. And as it turns out, that nation has about the world's population. So inevitably, it's going to be an immensely powerful organism, particularly since we in the West invited China to participate in the World Trade Organization in the global trade environment. China could have remained, like North Korea, a hermit state. But under Deng Xiaoping, effectively, they decided to take the plunge and enter into the deep waters, the ocean, if you like, with all the risks of an open economy integrated into the world, in which Australia was the example of one of the most integrated economies into China. The only example of an economy even more integrated would be Taiwan. But we didn't really expect China to perform in the way that it has. And we looked on China as we did on Japan after the Second World War, when we would routinely talk about a jerry job, meaning, you know, a half-baked, poorly executed, and then suddenly we found the automotive industry. And now we've seen, you know, this capacity of the essentially ethnically unified Pan-Han population. And this is goes to your question about opposition, that there is a Confucian idea of support for the tribal or national leadership, which makes the population, you know, more deferential towards its leaders. And then that is overlaid with this ethnic unity. While there's plenty of ethnic diversity on the margins of China, the overwhelming horsepower of a united Han Chinese ethno state is a very, very powerful point.
We've got to go to a break, and then we're going to be back to continue this conversation with Ross Cameron. I've got so many questions with the propositions you have raised, Ross. You're listening to TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Fox, how's that firing Tucker working out for you?
Only 90,000 people in their key demographic still watch Fox during Tucker's 8 o'clock slot.
Folks, Tucker had 3.3 million people watching. He had over a million people in that key 24 to 54 demographic.
Megyn Kelly, the girl that went to elementary school just down the street here in Syracuse, New York, put it best when she dubbed Fox Foxweiser. Have we ever seen two more magnificent self-immolations than Anheuser-Busch and Fox News Corporation? In both instances, it's irreparable. This isn't like O'Reilly's fire, okay? Because O'Reilly, they laid the groundwork, they had a drip campaign of whispers and innuendos and allegations. There was nothing against Tucker. All of a sudden, bam, you're gone. People have had enough. We're finally voting with our feet, voting with our wallets, and Fox News is dead.
The Reckoning with Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Emergency.
Hi, I think my husband might need an ambulance.
Joe, I'm fine.
Can you tell me what happened?
Well, this morning his chest was aching. Now it's spread to his back and jaw.
Joe, it's nothing.
He sounds short of breath. Is he sweating?
Yes.
An ambulance is on its way. He may be having a heart attack.
A heart attack is not always as dramatic as you think. If you or someone else experience these symptoms, call 111 immediately. The longer you wait, the more permanent damage to your heart. Go to heartfoundation.org.nz to learn more.
Some people are afraid of spiders. Some people sharks or clowns. Some people are afraid of things that go bump in the night, while others are afraid of things that go... Pool phobia is a problem because bowel cancer is our number two cancer killer, and the majority of people over 50 aren't using the screening kit that comes in the mail. Don't be afraid to test your poo. Go to stickittonumber2.com.au. A message from Cancer Council WA.
And here's Heather with the weather.
Well, it's beautiful out there, sunny and 75, almost a little chilly in the shade. Now, let's get a read on the inside of your car. It is hot. You've only been parked a short time and it's already 99 degrees in there. Let's not leave children in the back seat while running errands. It only takes a few minutes for their body temperatures to rise, and that could be fatal.
Cars get hot fast and can be deadly. Never leave a child in a car. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Today's News Talk Radio.
Come on, let the man talk.
We never censor our hosts.
Good. Now, talk.
Uncensored news.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Are they tailoring these ads to the listeners? Or are they tailoring them to me? Because that screening kit ad for bowel cancer, Western Australia, was like a little bit close to the bone in the 50s. Yeah, they've sent me out a few kits. I haven't used them. Instead, I had to put a piece of stool in a jar and I just went, ugh. Cancer versus still in it. Anyway, I've been guilt tripped into it. If anyone's listening from the department, could you please send me out another kit? We're talking to Ross Cameron about more serious issues than that. Of course, well, I mean, you know, my mortality, I suppose, is the most serious issue I could possibly ever deal with, but probably not Ross's. Ross, you were saying things before, too, about the Chinese government, and it feels to me like there's a lot of things that happened in the West to facilitate this, and that was the prominence that finance took and primacy it took over labour, the cost of labour. So finance became everything. So we basically gave away our manufacturing inheritance to a cheaper alternative, which was Chinese.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's inherently problematic if you the whole story of international trade. We could go back to David Ricardo, who was the original sort of theoretician of international trade, a contemporary of John Stuart Mill's, and where at the time, you know, the Britain was a great promoter of free trade. Now Britain is a great promoter of tariff and sanctions and trade protection, as indeed is the US. But what we find, ironically, is that when Xi Jinping goes to Davos, he is the clearest and firmest voice in favour of free trade. But it is all of those who are trying to hold China's head underwater who are constantly finding new reasons to promote sanctions. But look, the issue is as economies mature, say the Australian economy, it is natural that emerging economies will be able to deliver. I mean, I've just returned from days in Fiji, and there you have the minimum wage is $4 Fijian per hour. $4 Fijian is about, you know, $2.70 Australian per hour. So it is absolutely natural and inevitable if you have a genuinely free trade environment that a country with a much cheaper wage base is going to be more competitive in producing relatively unsophisticated products. The challenge for Australia is that if you are going to demand $22.50 an hour as your minimum wage, then you must transition your economy into very high value, elaborately transformed products if you wish to stay competitive. The problem for Australia is that we allowed ourselves to be hollowed out on the lower value manufacturing, but we did not develop the engineering confidence and capability to move into the higher value. And so we are, in effect, falling between stools, where we have virtually, no manufacturing sector left.
We're going to become the much-touted clever country for quite some time there. It was talked about all the time that we've become the clever country, which didn't eventuate. We're going to go to news headlines, and we'll be straight back to continue the conversation with Ross Cameron, who obviously has his own show on the weekends too on TNT Radio. You are listening to TNT Radio.
Big news, news, news.
A story which contains more than first meets the ear.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylant here with your TNT headlines. Ukraine's military intelligence chief has admitted Kyiv has assassinated a number of Russian citizens. Over 200 former world leaders, defence ministers and diplomats have penned an open letter to the G7, urging the bloc to not let the war in Ukraine stand in the way of critical nuclear talks between Russia and the US. And the leader of South Africa's opposition party has called for African nations to withdraw from the International Criminal Court.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Russ, you're talking about the primacy of the Han Chinese and it's a homogeneous culture. Is that also why we see them act so effectively as a cohesive force that accepts its hierarchy? Because we even saw it in a lot of the lockdowns. I noticed in Australia when there was big pushback to the lockdowns, very few ethnic Asians were part of that pushback. They were very happy to go along. Is that something that's of an ethnic characteristic?
Look, I would say there is a Confucian ethic, and what you find in China is a culture which is shaped by its, you know, 5,000 years of unbroken history, a pictographic-based written language, its Confucian values, and more recently, the influence of Marxism as adapted by Mao, and then subsequently by sort of five or six very significant leaders since the about 1980. And this combination of variables is what makes up the mystery of China. But, you know, the Chinese tradition is that it's not a blank check for the leadership. If the leadership fails, there has been a very long tradition in China of challenging and overthrowing the leadership. But in a situation where you've got the Chinese Communist Party, which has effectively lifted, you know, there's virtually no one in China who is now living under what the UN describes as the world poverty level. And the sort of deal is, the unspoken deal, it's not written down in a constitution, but so long as the Chinese leadership continues to deliver economic growth and individual prosperity and growing opportunity, it will not be challenged by the population. But if China were, for example, if the Chinese leadership were to preside over another famine of the kind that was widespread during the Cultural Revolution, I think that compact would come under intense stress. And the Chinese leadership is very conscious of that fact. And, you know, we say that China is a authoritarian single-party state, which is true. On the other hand, we don't really have a lot of insight if you were to hold a referendum in China today and say, do you prefer to retain the existing leadership or would you prefer to create a liberal multi-party democracy? I don't know what the answer to that question is.
Did Tiananmen Square give us an inkling of what the answer to that question might be?
Well, it's possible. Okay, it's possible. And it tells you that I don't think there would be a, you know, I don't think you would have a single view. There would be lots of dissenting and alternative views. You know, the Chinese leadership, if you take Tiananmen Square, the only thing I would say in defense of, you know, Jiang Zemin and Deng Xiaoping is when China does fall into revolt, the river, the blood flows in rivers. You know, you're talking about, if you look at the Boxer Rebellion, some of the most bloody, lethal mass killings take place when civic order breaks down in China. So, you know, we may disagree with the pace of reform. We may prefer that there is greater opportunity for participation by ordinary citizens under democratic processes in China. But, you know, all I would say to you, Damon, is we have to decide, do we believe in the idea of the sovereign state out of the Treaty of Westphalia in the 1640s, where we said, okay, the doctrine of the West will be, we'll have a series of sovereign states, we will respect each other's right to choose our own domestic policies, we will not seek to molest or enforce external values on individual countries, and each country will be responsible for its own outcomes. Now, you can't believe in sovereignty when it suits you, but dump it when you prefer to impose your own will. And I simply say that, you know, the Chinese leadership so far, I disagree with the Chinese Communist Party on a number of matters. I'm happy to put my alternative view to them, as indeed I have done to senior figures in the Chinese Communist Party. But I say to you, in the end, it's their call. And, you know, I don't seek to promote colour revolutions to overturn elected, and sovereign leadership in other states such as Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Ukraine.
You talk about the Treaty of Westphalia, right? And that's like a pre-democratic period in the Western tradition, what we come to know as democracy now, is democracy actually what undermines that now, the nation state, because the democratic institutions have spawned these massive bureaucratic organisations that are internationalist in their understanding. So is that actually now what oppresses our liberty? Would we be better? Sometimes I think in my darker moments under a feudal rule where there was a king who had ultimate authority, but this constant buck passing that we get today. Well, I'm the minister today, but there's a new minister tomorrow, and it's not my responsibility. I can't tell you what the last minister did, but I'm charged with cleaning up the mess. Whereas in the feudal system, as you talk about, even in the Chinese system, is ultimately they hold the leader to account. But in our system, there's no accountability.
Yeah, I say that we are no longer a democratic state. Places like Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK, we are post-democratic states. We went through a democratic phase, but under which the sort of political doctrine is that the citizen is sovereign, and the citizen chooses the government, and the government acts under a democratic mandate, whereas we have moved into a new model of government, which is effectively a collusion between the state and federal bureaucracies, a group of foreign bureaucracies and non-government organisations, the corporations and the legacy media, and they have figured out that they can develop a business model which works perfectly well without the influence or control of citizens who are sort of irritant, and they have managed to reduce the citizens to a single job, which is to fund the operation, but to exercise no real influence or control.
And not totally unlike the Chinese model in a way, except it includes this perverse concept of social justice.
Yeah, I think the what we are getting in Australia is all of the costs of collectivism, socialism, state-dominated economies, but without the benefit of Chinese efficiency.
Ross Cameron, I've got to thank you so much for joining me on the Damien Richardson Show. What your show's on a Sunday, isn't it, on TNT Radio?
7 to 9 p.m.
7 to 9 p.m. this Sunday. You can be even more elucidated with the Ross Cameron Show. Thanks so much for making the Friday Damien Richardson Show so much more interesting, Ross.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You're listening to TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
When people tell you who they are, believe them. And remember, actions speak louder than words. When Catherine, Princess of Wales, captured the imagination of millions around the globe, garnering praise from every corner for her flawless performance of a piano instrumental piece written specifically for her and recorded in the Crimson Drawing Room at Windsor Castle, the castle the royal family considers home, as part of the Eurovision Song Contest opening over the weekend. You just knew that Sparkle Markle had to somehow horn in on all the attention that Kate was getting. So of course now we're hearing tales of a 2-hour high-speed, very dangerous, potentially fatal car chase through the streets of Manhattan with poor Sparkle and her mother and her spare cuck of a husband being hounded by paparazzi who only wanted to reunite Harry with his mother. And of course, none of it's true. This is yet another juicy sommelier moment for the Duke and Duchess of Nothing. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Black Lives Matter use of confrontation and violence has attracted criticism from other civil rights groups. Barbara Reynolds, a veteran of the 1960 civil rights movement, writes that many civil rights activists agree with BLM's goals, but fundamentally disagree with their approach. According to Reynolds, BLM uses confrontational and divisive tactics rather than proven protest methods. The BLM movement protesters have harassed presidential candidates, and critics argue it has become a movement concerned with instilling fear in politicians, white people, and police. BLM has been blamed for worsening race relations in America. Federal Bureau of Investigation has found that homicides of police officers have risen since 2014, and some observers identify Black Lives Matter protests as a contributing case to an anti-police environment. The FBI reported that perpetrators of attacks on police in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Dallas, Texas, stated they were influenced by the Black Lives Matter movement. Adding to the concern that BLM encourages anti-police violence are statements by BLM endorsing historical extreme-left anti-police terrorists.
Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
This TNT host lost his eternal vigilance before. I think I was a bit beguiled by Ross Cameron's language, and I didn't even talk about what I had him on the show to talk about. We have this thing where you fill it in when you're going to have a guest on the show, and you say exactly what it is that you're going to talk about. And I was going to discuss what had happened at the Liberty event that the Liberals had as a plan of action at their Federal Executive Council meeting in Mornington. I described what I was going to talk to him about, and then we ended up talking about international diplomacy and the West vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party, and it just felt like the right way to go. So my apologies to anybody who was looking forward to hearing what happens at these Liberty events of the Liberal Party. Is there some hope there still for the West? Well, we might even find out, because I'm talking to Erica Betts hopefully early next week, and we can actually have that discussion with Eric instead. And since he was actually at the event, it's probably a much better person to talk to it about. Now, we've got this little promotion too with world-renowned cardiologist, public health campaigner, and best-selling author, Dr. Asim Malhotra will be touring Australia with the Australian Medical Professional Society, AMPS, sponsored by TNT Radio, beginning on May the 27th. The tour will cover several cities across the country, raising public awareness about vaccine injuries and providing a risk-benefit evidence-based analysis of the COVID vaccines, with special emphasis on cardiovascular complications and, most importantly, solutions. The tour is open to the public and will provide an opportunity to engage with Dr. Malhotra and other experts in the field. For tickets and more information, visit amps.redunion.com.au. That's amps.redunion.com.au. And that brings me to my final guest for this hour and for this show, indeed for this week. It's a former police officer. I have talked to him, it would be over a month ago now, and it's Mark. Former police officer, former copper. Mark, are you there, mate?
Yeah, g'day, mate. Go on.
G'day. Good on you, buddy. Yeah, no, I just thought I'd say g'day to you first. Geez, tell me, give me the hurry up already. Okay, so, Mark, now what's happening? Yeah, there's a 95-year-old woman in New South Wales, the great-grandmother, and she's been tasered in her nursing home, and now she's in intensive care in Cooma Hospital south of the ACT. It seems
it's comical if it wasn't so serious, right? 95 years of age and she's fighting for her life. But you've obviously brought me on to make some comments, and that's all I can do, some opinions based on my experience. Mm-hmm. Obviously I wasn't there, but just to qualify that, just near on 15 years I did some time ago now, but 15 years operationally. So I was out and about on divvy vans and watch hours and that sort of thing. So dealing with the violence and all that sort of thing that came our way for 15 years, and obviously had an impact on my mental health. We're not here to talk about that at the moment. But, I haven't seen too many – I didn't meet too many 95-year-olds that are a real threat to me, Damien. Now, unless something's, really odd or bizarre happened in this situation, it just sounds ludicrous, doesn't it?
It does. So what are the protocols there? Like, obviously someone from the nursing home has rang the Cooma police.
Yeah, well, I just read an article just moments ago that suggested, or somebody was suggesting, the author, I guess, that the staff had actually made a mistake. Because that was my initial thought, was why would staff, this is obviously one of their residents that they, and they have dementia and they deal with all those sorts of things and situations with them all the time. Why would they be calling police into that?
Yeah, it's
it's just in any case. Okay, so police are being called. You know, I would well myself. As I say, I didn't deal with too many 94-year-olds. It might have been a violent threat to me, but I would have just been starting up some conversation, even if the dementia had caused it, because they can have, you know, violent flashes, you might say, or they look that way. They're obviously angry. They don't even know why. It's part of the disease. But basically, I wouldn't expect a 95-year-old to be advancing that quickly to me, whether they had a knife or anything with them. And my thoughts with that would just be to talk down the situation.
So what's the training like in that situation for a young constable coming into the force? They're trained to deal with the domestic situation.
Well, I don't know about so much now, but you know, back in my day, it was definitely, I mean, no one wants to use lethal force. So they had, eventually we actually, I was thinking about this, I think it was in the early 90s or something, I can't remember. There was around the time when there was a lot of police shooting, so they had they ran a program or an operation called Operation Beacon, which was to change, you know, the way that police engaged in violent situations. However, look, I was, myself and many other police I knew just seemed to have an instinct for, I mean, at that stage we didn't have all the stuff that they had on their belts, which I think is a bit ludicrous to have all the weaponry they have, but we basically just had a sidearm and a baton and, you know, ourselves. And also, you know, if things went a little bit beyond talking, we often would try and just overpower people physically. Obviously it is a little bit difficult with a knife, but I can tell you that, yeah, I'm still here to tell the tale. And yes, I did have my firearm out sometimes, not often, but a small amount of times, actually pointed at people. I can think of a person actually who was a lot younger and a lot bigger than this woman, obviously, but he had a knife pointed at me and I just talked him down at gunpoint, if you like. In fact, in that situation, he lost sight of my partner. He got around and clocked him over the head, basically, and he fell on the floor. But you see, it's sort of it's an interesting conundrum, isn't it? Now they want to resolve everything without violence, and yet they've become more violent. So there's a whole conversation there, I think.
And what is that conversation there, Mark?
Well, I'm just aware of our time, but I just don't think they're getting the training. Even before that, I don't think in a lot of respects the right profile of person is being recruited now. I'll talk about the topic that no one wants to talk about, is that too many women on the front line. You know, they just do not have the physical strength to deal with most of the, particularly the violent situations, which puts everybody in jeopardy. Yeah, go on.
So that makes them more likely in that instance to use a taser when in a different situation a man might actually just physically restrain
them. Well, with the taser, I don't really know whether it was a female officer or not, so I'm not really making a direct comment there. But
it becomes cultural, surely. If that's what's happening, what other people are doing, you're going to do it as well because you're not going to jump on this.
Yeah. I mean, my opinion would be that a taser can be lethal, obviously, and that's just way over the top for that particular situation. And I just can't imagine, as I said, I wasn't there, but I can't imagine a 95-year-old springing towards you with a knife in her hand, screaming that I'm going to kill you or something like that. I just don't think that happened. I might be wrong, but I don't think so. Go on.
I was just going to say, this goes to the heart, doesn't it, of the problem that police have and their liaison with the community. So this is the worst possible thing that could happen. I mean, things go wrong. Things happen, especially because you're dealing with such difficult circumstances. But just imagine a woman in a nursing home at 95 years of age. But this would make it even harder to recruit for police, because I know you're a former Victorian police officer. You still deal with the colleagues from the Victorian Police Force, keep abreast of what's happening there. And they are having really serious recruitment problems, aren't they, as a result of the use of excessive force throughout the pandemic in particular.
There's a lot of factors to it, Damien, but the end result at the moment is, and it's not just me making the comment, I saw it on TV just during the week. I'm not sure exactly what the program was, but something like one of our current affair programs, and the police right across Australia, that is the police command, are admitting they're in crisis. They're in a crisis situation in relation to crew. In other words, the numbers are so low that they can't properly police or look after the citizens of Australia.
So in Queensland, they've taken it to the point where they're going to actually recruit 2,500 police officers over the next 5 years, so 500 a year from foreign jurisdictions. That's also a problem, isn't it? Because you'd have no relationship to the culture in which you're operating in.
Yeah, if you thought you had no relationship now, well, that's just going to slide down into a negative, isn't it? You would imagine. And, look, that's something that changed as well over time. You know, definitely when I was in, and I felt myself personally, you know, because I'm a good Aussie bloke, that I was there to protect the community in the best way. You know, there's different ways of doing that, but one of the best ways is to integrate into the community and be the helpful, you know, copper around the joint. And sure, there's, you know, there's the bad people that are out to get you, and you got to keep an eye on that. But I don't, the solution isn't to become isolated, and that's what I see happening now. The police, well, we don't know them. I don't know my local police. I'm sure you don't know your local police. And, no, you know, they're supposed
grateful,
to be.
I'm grateful for that sometimes.
Yeah. And that's the problem, you know, what you just mentioned there. I mean, you know, in some ways the community not only feel unprotected, but they almost, I don't know whether fear is the right word, perhaps a little bit of their police. You know, because when these things start happening, I know this event's happened in New South Wales, but, you know, it makes you really question, you know, let's be honest, who the hell are they recruiting the police force now? Who are these people, you know, or that, and are they actually training them to be, you know, really violent, like, you know, use lethal force? If in doubt, use lethal force almost seems to be a mantra.
No, I was just going to say, you grasped the nettle before and you mentioned the unmentionable, the feminization of the workforce in general, particularly the police practice. And there's obviously some areas which are totally feminized and always have been, like nursing would be a classic example of that, teaching to high rates of female employees. But why has there been an ideological push to feminize the police force? And what are the results? What are the consequences? Maybe. Yep.
I think it's part of which we've spoken about before, perhaps not on radio, but it's part of that wider feminisation, isn't it? And push to have females in certain jobs. And so, you know, they're equal to the task. Now, that you have to look at that, you know, for myself, I've got nothing against females. I mean, I've got two lovely daughters and a wife, and it's not coming from that angle at all. The way I view it succinctly is if we're invaded tomorrow and, you know, we had to send people out to protect their shores, are you sending out a group of women or a group of blokes? Seriously.
Are you suggesting equality wouldn't matter anymore under those circumstances, Mark?
Well, look, I can only tell you from my point of view, from a bloke that's worked out on the street in the divvy vans, that sort of thing, as I said. I mean... you know, I didn't talk about it much in the job because I guess there was for me it was like, you know, you don't rat on your mates and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, I've been out with women, you know, where you're on the side of the road, pulled up a load of young fellas that are giving me a bit of lip and the women just go and lock themselves in the divvy van. I've had that happen and I'm not the only one.
And then what happens? What happens after that?
Well, you have to say, okay, I can't do my job anymore. You've got to back off. You know, I'm not gonna, you know, I've been there. That was a real situation. So I was one against five or six who were, you know, they weren't physically getting violent, but they were certainly letting me know that, you know, I wasn't welcome in pulling them up by the side of the road and they were going to give me a hard time. And suddenly I became one out. I believe even worse than one out. I'm not there with another bloke, another mate, so I have to back off. And I remember actually distinctly in my head, maybe this is why this particular one sort of factors in my memory, which is quite some years ago. It was a tipping point, I think, where I said, you know what, Mark, you just can't do your job anymore. You just can't do it. You know, you can't get out there and do what's required to protect the community.
And what ability do you have after anecdotal situations like that? And you've said there's other members you've talked to who have had similar situations. Mm-hmm. What ability do you have to go back to command and report this as being the reality on the ground that's actually stopping you from doing your job?
Well, you'll be told that you're misogynist and, you know, we've got to treat everyone equally, all that sort of stuff they go on with, all those political comments, which is what they are, aren't they? They're not a real comment. They're just political.
And, so equality would include the feeling supported by a colleague in a dangerous situation.
Yeah. Look, Damien, there are some policemen which are quite capable of carrying themselves physically. You know, don't worry about that. But I believe they're in a minority. But and also, they're very valuable people for all sorts of other duties. You know, they've got a high attention to detail, usually, a lot of them, and they make very good detectives, all that sort of thing. So I'm not just
saying... A softer approach might work at times as well?
Yeah. Look, it's a softer approach, yeah. I don't know. You see, that's where... I when I...
I'm...